Japan's extreme oil scarcity, exacerbated by the oil embargo that had been put in place by the United States and other Western powers before the war, had been one of the major factors that precipitated the outbreak of hostilities. Capturing the oil wells of the Dutch East Indies became Japan's paramount goal upon initiating the war. Because every drop of gasoline was considered virtually sacred, the Japanese Army chose to invest little in troop-carrying trucks, jeeps, and other modes of ground transport. What little gasoline existed was reserved primarily for planes, ships, and tanks. Soldiers were expected to hike long distances, 25 or 30 miles a day, as a matter of course. Marching represented a much more significant part of the Japanese training regimen than it did for the American foot soldier. Japanese troops generally marched more often, for longer duration, and at a faster pace than did the Americans, who relied heavily on vehicles, in large part due to the U.S. Army's ready access to cheap and plentiful gas. This major difference in the two armies contributed to a gulf in the perception of what constituted a reasonable distance for a day's march. The Japanese unrealistically expected the starved and diseased Filipino-American forces to meet the Imperial Army's norms for marching, again with tragic consequences. There was another major cultural difference that influenced many encounters between the Japanese and their new captives. The two armies entertained radically different views on the matter of corporal punishment. Beating had long been an acceptable and routine method of discipline within the Japanese Army. Soldiers could strike subordinates with no questions asked and no explanation warranted. The slightest distinction between ranks was of critical importance because it meant the difference between who could inflict blows and who could expect to receive them. This sort of institutionalized brutality had a tendency to work its way down the ranks to the lowliest private. One can imagine what would happen when an enlisted man, hardened by this psychology of top-down violence, found himself suddenly thrown into a foreign and not altogether distasteful situation in which he was the superior, in charge of a group of helpless prisoners. For some, the temptation to beat proved irresistible. For others, beating was only the beginning. It was also true that many of the Imperial Army soldiers were themselves desperately hungry and ravaged by the same diseases that ravaged their captives. Although they hadn't deteriorated as far as the Americans had, many Japanese soldiers were showing signs of emaciation and battle fatigue. "We were all starving," recalled Shiro Asada, a 14th Army soldier on Bataan. "We had dried fish paste and pickles to eat. That was all. Canned goods like the Americans had were a luxury to us. It seemed to us that some of the Americans were better fed than we were." As a matter of official policy, the Imperial Army showed a remarkable reluctance to provision its own troops. Army quartermasters provided only a bare minimum of such staples as miso and rice, but soldiers were expected to forage and steal to make up the caloric deficit. Thus, swiping rations or canteens from American prisoners wasn't merely a matter of the strong taking advantage of the weak. It was practically an Imperial Army imperative. The Americans, already living so close to the bone, would have to make do with even less. For how could an army that barely fed its own be expected to provide adequate meals for 78,000 enemy prisoners? General Masaharu Homma, preoccupied with his plans for assaulting Corregidor, apparently remained oblivious to the enormity of the disaster that passed by his Balanga headquarters each day. Certainly, General Homma was operating under enormous pressures from Tokyo. His career and professional honor were on the line. The Imperial Army Chief of Staff, General Hajime Sugiyama, had threatened on several occasions to remove Homma from his command. In Sugiyama's estimation, Homma was feckless, indecisive, and far too soft on the enemy. The master plan had called for Homma to take the Philippines by February, but the war had dragged on until April, and Corregidor still held. Refusing to consider the possibility that the master plan was unrealistic in the first place, Sugiyama thought the delays inexcusable and placed all blame at Homa's feet. In fact, the chief of staff's doubts about Homa went back a number of years. He had taken a dim view of Homa's pro-British leanings before the war, and had reluctantly offered the poet general the assignment to invade the Philippines, only out of deference to Homa's established brilliance as a strategist.